This is How Sound, the backstory to great audio storytelling. PRX and Transom make this podcast possible. I'm Rob Rosenthal, and I want you to know there are a couple of swears in this episode. Just a heads up. I'm stealing an idea from the Columbia Journalism Review. They used to publish a column called Darts and Laurels. They'd give a dart to bad journalism and a laurel to good journalism. For this episode of How Sound, that's what I'm doing, handing out darts and laurels for audio storytelling. First, a laurel to NPR. No reporter in particular, no story in particular, just NPR, the radio and podcast network. 2021 marks NPR's 50th anniversary. They launched in September of 1971. And the reason for the laurel is simple. NPR set the standard for audio storytelling and reporting in the U.S. Regardless of who and what you listen to produced in the States these days, they stand on NPR's shoulders. In particular, I want to note the sound quality of NPR's work. There's an attention to production values that is unsurpassed. Yes, COVID has hampered the ability to record the best-sounding interviews. Sometimes these days I look at my radio while listening to NPR's news programs and I think, who the heck let that on the air? The guest sounds like they're talking through a tin can, but that's the exception. In general, my ears detect the care with which everything is produced, a level of care I wish everyone producing audio stories practiced. To give a sense of what I mean, I have a CD that NPR released in 1991 for the network's 20th anniversary. I think How Sound listeners will appreciate this clip. Susan Stamberg, who narrates on the disc, takes listeners into an edit room where one of the engineers is cutting reel-to-reel tape.
Let's start by finding a place to begin. Now what I do is, I've heard where I want to start, and I rock the tapes back. Find the location. There it is. And then I can mark that point on the playback head, and that will demarcate the beginning, let's say, of our interview.
John Baer edits tape the way no one else here can edit it. All the other tape cutters agree, Smokey is our Picasso, our Casals. He edits tape more quickly, more slyly, more lyrically, more skillfully than anyone on the staff. He is the dean of the razor blade. That's his basic tool, the blade, plus a grease pencil and a roll of sticky white tape. His real tool, of course, is his steady knowledge of how radio should sound. Here's an example. One day we received a taped interview with the singer Bo Diddley. Smokey liked the tape, but decided it could be enhanced by adding some recorded music.
So I wrote me a tune that had the same feel that I could do my lyrics to. Ham bone, like that, you know, something like that.
Sounds simple, doesn't it? Get the record, sneak it in under the taped interview. But it was not that simple. Smokey discovered that Bo Diddley was singing faster on the tape than he sang on the record. And when he first tried to mix the two sounds together, they didn't fit. So Smokey slowed the taped Bo Diddley down. Meticulously, surgically, he slipped silences in between Bo Diddley's words, as many short silences as he needed to make the tape mesh with the record. By adding silence, Smokey retained what was there to begin with, but made it better.
I want to underscore something here. The engineer aligned the music and interview on reel-to-reel tape. These days, inserting silence is fairly easy. Cut and paste, 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 wherever you need it. But inserting silence on reel-to-reel tape? Let's just say there was no Command V. It was painstaking work. As Susan notes, with razor blades and China markers. It's crazy to think about. So a laurel to NPR for attention to audio detail throughout their 50 years. Okay, now on to a dart.
Hey friends, it's Mr. Jim, and welcome back to Kids Short Stories, where we turn your ideas into some amazing adventures. And guess what? Today's story comes to us from our live Zoom session from the premium subscribers. We have constructed an amazing idea just now, and I cannot wait to share it with you. Ellington and Grayson are going to be saving the day from a dragon that just ate some spicy tacos. Oh, dear. Are you guys ready for today's adventure? Me too. Let's go.
Let me stop this right here. This is a podcast called Kids Short Stories, and I'm handing out a dart for the way the host, Mr. Jim, talks to kids. I can't stand that. Why do adults think they need to talk to kids that way? Where does that voice even come from? Yeesh. Now look, I understand the need to be performative when telling stories to kids, to be performative whenever telling a story, but really, do adults need to be that melodramatic? It's a turnoff, and I think somewhat disrespectful of kids. They aren't that jelly-brained. Here's a little bit more from the episode, Ellington and Grayson Rescue the Dragon from Spicy Tacos.
Oh man, I'm so hungry I could eat a buffalo.
That was the voice of a dragon named Archer. He was a dragon that lived in an enchanted forest, and this forest was so special that anything you wanted to eat, if you just imagined it, that food would magically appear on a very magical tree stump. This tree stump had been there for hundreds of years, and something magical happened there all the time.
I do like the idea behind the podcast. Kids submit story ideas. They write up a short description of a story, one, two, three sentences long or so, and then they send it in. Then Mr. Jim, whose real name is Jim Jacob, he writes and performs a story based on that idea. This is the same format as another podcast, Story Pirates, which has been around longer and features guest actors like John Oliver and Julie Andrews. Kids Short Stories is more low budget, which I find appealing. So even though it's very similar, there's room for more than one podcast like this, of course. If for no other reason, then this is a creative way for a podcast to encourage parents to spend time with their kids. It engages a young person's imagination and a parent's, and aside from maybe listening on a phone, it doesn't involve a screen, so hooray for that. But I still wonder about all the vocal theatrics.
You guys saved the day. Great job!
Really? Must you? Though I will say, my 4-year-old grandson doesn't seem to mind the voice. He loves the show, so what do I know?
Hello.
Just go through the door, go to the elevator, and come up to the 3rd floor.
Thank you so much, Ruth.
This is Nice Try. It's a podcast from Vox Media and Curbed. It's hosted by Avery Truffleman.
I want to start this with the act of entering someone else's home. An act that is at times mundane or exciting or transgressive, especially if one is barging in with a microphone.
You're already recording?
I am. You know, it's like...
Come on in.
I'll tell you why. I usually don't like...
Season 1 of Nice Try was about failed utopian experiments, about the yearning for more beautiful, more equitable, more pleasurable ways of living across centuries and around the world. And even though so many of these utopian efforts fell apart, that hunger remains. This feeling that there has to be a way to a better, different lifestyle. So this season is about where all those utopian yearnings got channeled, at least in the United States.
When I was a young adult,
I'll readily admit I'm a fan of Avery. I liked her stories on 99% Invisible and Articles of Interest, which was a podcast about fashion. She's a rock-solid audio storyteller. As for Nice Try, the second season recently dropped. This time, Avery reports stories about lifestyle products. Vacuums, crock pots, mattresses. She explores the utopia these products promise and what they actually deliver. In the case of the first episode, about doorbells, the promise has evolved into a kind of dystopia. Here's a clip, and I'd like you to listen for something that I really enjoy about Avery's stories, her narration. She's so natural. She doesn't just deliver information. She leans in. I can feel her telling the story, which stems from her writing, so I guess listen to both the writing and her delivery.
Once upon a time, I was throwing a party. And I remember I wrote in bold in the email invitation, please ring the bell to get in, because I was hosting and I didn't want to have to keep checking my phone all night. But sure enough, everyone just texted when they arrived and no one rang the bell. But I can't really throw stones because I, too, am one of these people who would rather text than use the doorbell. I was just like, I don't want to bother people. And I don't really have good associations with that buzz. At best, it's a delivery of some kind. But at worst, it's someone who's trying to sell you something, interrogate you, or bother you. It's obviously someone who doesn't have your number. And I'm not alone in my aversion to the doorbell. I mean, just ask someone who rang doorbells every single day working for the last census.
See what I mean? Great narration. There was an old guy. I will say, I don't understand the idea of texting someone to let them know you've arrived. Just ring or knock, for crying out loud. I should mention, this episode gets dark. The dystopian aspect of doorbells comes later in the story when Avery reports on the increased use of smart doorbells. These are doorbells with cameras like Nest from Google and Ring from Amazon. Avery skillfully leads listeners to questions about surveillance ethics. What expectation of privacy should a person have when they arrive at someone's door or even just walking by on the street?
I don't even know how to open the gate.
My friend Tammy invited me over to check out the Ring doorbell her landlord had recently installed. And even though I was there specifically to check out Tammy's Ring doorbell, I couldn't figure out how to get past the gate, so I ended up having to do the, like, texting that I'm here thing.
Gonna have to text. How does one get to the doorbell?
Ring basically bridges the divide between ringing and texting. It's essentially a doorbell that alerts your phone, and it shows a video of whoever's outside, and you don't need to be home to answer it and to talk and engage with whoever's outside. And by the way, I'm sorry if I'm mansplaining how Ring works if you have one, because you very well might have one. Ring has sold more than 1.4 million video doorbells in 2020.
So this is it.
This is it.
Is that the sound it makes?
That's the sound that...
There's motion. Oh, it caught me fucking with the gate.
No, it caught you, like, just now passing the camera.
And then, can you see a video of me?
Sure can.
Is that the sound it makes? It caught me fucking with the gate.
No, it caught you, like, just now passing the camera.
This doorbell caught me from pretty far away. Like, Tammy's gate is probably a solid 7 feet away from her door, and Tammy's entryway is obscured by the stairs to the first floor. I just say this because, from the street, I could not see the camera. I didn't know I was being recorded. And, by the way, I did not look cute in this footage.
It is just funny that, like, everything looks sketchy with a fisheye lens.
Yeah,
you know?
It looks like you're trying to commit a crime.
That's Avery Truffleman and Nice Try. A laurel to her and the crew at Nice Try for the writing, narration, and storytelling. Now, back to a dart, though I'll be honest, this is very awkward. Truly. I'm about to critique a story by someone who is living through an incredibly difficult period in their life. I was tempted to just not say anything, but I felt a need to point out an aspect of the storytelling that really stuck in my craw. So first, let me start with what I like.
Remember that movie, Nebraska? You may not have seen it. It starred Bruce Dern as an elderly man who thinks he's won the lottery.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska?
That's right. To get my $1 million.
And his son, played by Will Forte, has to retrieve him because he keeps trying to walk to Nebraska from Montana.
This is Woody Grant.
We are now authorized to pay $1 million.
You can tell pretty soon his mind isn't all there, but he's determined to make this trip.
You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam, so you gotta stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
I actually saw this movie with my dad maybe 10 years ago. I could not imagine at that time that I would ever be the Will Forte character, but eventually I, too, had to figure out how to take care of my dad as he got older. This is Demented, a podcast about what happens when you become your parent's parent. I'm Kitty Eisley.
Okay, I'll stop here for a second. I am so pleased that Texas Public Radio produced a podcast about dementia. And I'm grateful that Kitty Eisley, the reporter, was brave. Brave enough to talk honestly about a life-altering event, taking care of her father with dementia for several years, right up to his death a few months ago. I don't know how many podcasts there are about dementia, but probably not enough. Caretakers need all the advice they can get, and beyond advice, they need to know they're not alone. This podcast accomplishes that, and based on the handful of reviews at Apple, the listeners to the podcast agree. Let's listen to a little more.
I started taking notes and keeping a diary of my experience taking care of my dad as he got older and sicker. The idea came after Dad took a really misguided road trip through the Midwest, like Bruce Dern's character. It had been just a couple of years since my mom died, and my dad's health had declined dramatically. Dad developed congestive heart failure, which led to a lot of problems. Lack of oxygen to his brain, for one. And that's brought on a great deal of confusion and memory loss. He was constantly losing things. His glasses, his cell phone, his wallet, and then calling to see if I could help locate them. One time he even lost his car. He forgot which garage he left it in. In the summer of 2017, my dad spent 3 weeks in the hospital when his heart almost gave out, and then another 6 weeks in a rehab unit learning to walk again, getting his balance and strength back. But it was still hard for him to accept that things had changed. So when he announced the Monday before Thanksgiving that he was going to fly to Minnesota for a funeral and then fly on to Iowa to spend the holiday with my cousins, alarm bells went off. He said he'd left a phone message for my cousins telling them he was coming. I wasn't even sure they'd gotten it. Before he even got on the plane, he lost his iPhone in the airport security line. He made it to Minnesota for the funeral, but that evening, the night before Thanksgiving, I got a phone call from the friend he was visiting. She said, "Did I know he had canceled his flight to Iowa and was planning to drive himself there instead?" A few years back, that would have been fine. He's made that drive many times. But this time was different. He was different. I called my dad at the hotel where he was staying, and we had a big fight. I told him, "You can't do this." And he hung up the phone on me because he was so angry. And that's so unlike him. That has never happened. So Thanksgiving morning, I called back. But he'd already checked out and hit the road. My cousin Julie was waiting for him that day in Iowa.
I think you and I talked about what time he left, and I calculated, okay, he should have been here long ago. It's a 4.5-hour drive from Minneapolis to Iowa City, and he had been traveling 6 to 8 hours, I believe. The problem was he was in a rental car, and we could have called the state patrol and had them look for him, but we didn't know what rental car he had, and you weren't able to find that information either.
Now the sun was going down, and my 81-year-old dad was lost somewhere in between Minneapolis and Iowa City in the snow, on a highway, on a holiday, with no phone. While everyone else is sitting down to turkey and stuffing, my sister and I are scrambling with my cousins and anyone we knew to see if we could locate him. I didn't know what to do.
That's good, right? Kitty clearly sets up the stakes with an anecdote that shows us her dad's state of mind and Kitty's. She's openly frustrated. So what's my beef? Well, two things. First, the title of the podcast, Demented. I'm not sure that's appropriate. My thesaurus offers these alternatives for the word demented: irrational, crazy, unreasonable, frenzied, uncontrolled, manic. Is that how we should be describing people with dementia? Maybe sometimes when their behavior warrants it, for sure. But for a whole podcast on the subject? I don't know. It seems pejorative. My second beef is this. Al Eisley, the dad, is largely portrayed in a negative manner throughout the podcast. He loses this. He doesn't understand that. He tries to do this other thing that he shouldn't be doing. He hurts himself. It's one difficulty after another. He's defined by his dementia. That's unfair, especially when based on the times we hear him in the podcast, he seems like he might not be able to fully speak for himself. I think it's incumbent upon reporters to give a sense of the fullness of someone's life when reporting on dementia. Of course, if this was a 3.5-minute public radio story, arguably there'd be little to no room to develop a character. But Demented is a 5-episode podcast. The whole series runs 80 minutes. Now, to be fair to Kitty, she does take a moment in the podcast to tell us her dad was a political writer. She says he wrote stories and editorials and book reviews. She even plays a little bit of tape of her father being interviewed on C-SPAN.
Al Isley is the editor of The Hill and has been so since September 94. Before that, he was the press secretary for Vice President Mondale. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rob.
What's your take?
He'd come to Washington as a reporter in 1965, done a stint in politics and policy, and from the mid-90s on, he helped start and then run a political newspaper, which was a late career joy for him. So much fun.
Caller has a good point. The budget agreement was a monstrosity. It was full of pork barrel projects.
And he read deeply and widely, and it seemed like everyone in Washington knew him and liked him. He is an honest and decent, friendly guy. He loved covering government and the people who make it work.
There are about a half a dozen Senate races that are too close to call and that will decide control of the Senate. Obviously, Minnesota now has to be, I think.
So it's really easy to find tape of him on C-SPAN as a reminder of his talent and his humor. And frankly, how different he is now.
That's it. We don't get to know her dad much at all. What childhood memories does she have of her dad? Who was he as a father? As a husband, a friend? How did her parents meet? What were the trying times in his life and the moments of joy? What about his funny habits? Maybe there were stories he told too many times. Did he ever give advice that has stayed with Kitty? I mean, I guess I have too many questions, but let me put it this other way. What is he losing as the dementia progresses, and what is Kitty losing? Or gaining, for that matter? Maybe there's some new aspect of their relationship that has developed that came as a complete surprise. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm utterly sympathetic to Kitty's predicament. It's difficult to rise above the daily challenges to see the bright spots. She captures that well, but it's one note. Fortunately, she interviews several different people with expertise with dementia, caretakers and a hospital chaplain. They offer sound advice and counsel to Kitty, and by extension, to listeners, and that's valuable. I just wish I got to know Al better and what it's meant to be his daughter throughout the years, not just the end. Okay, one last one. Big change in subject here. A Laurel for Weirdness. And that's not the name of the podcast. What I mean is, I've grown weary of formulaic podcasts. So many are like coloring by numbers. They're predictable and they're uninteresting. So when I hear something that breaks format, my ears perk up, like they did for The Skewer.
Blah, blah, blah.
A rescue operation is underway after Jacob Rees-Mogg collided with a pantomime horse. The government says those hurt will be given free treatment.
The health secretary confirmed that NHS staff in England must be killed by April next year.
You figure it has something to do with Boris?
Gutless man does not wear a mask.
Dominic Raab.
That's right.
The defence secretary Ben Wallace will today plead guilty to abusing at least 99 guinea pigs belonging to a neighbour.
Believe it or not, The Skewer is produced by the BBC. Doesn't sound like it, does it? The BBC can get experimental, but I didn't know they went this far. This is definitely a headphones-on podcast. Actually, you should be careful. If it's too loud, you may fall dizzy.
Should there be another vacancy on the Supreme Court during my presidency, my nominee will
be the Imperial, Magistrate.
Has the Imperial Magistrate reached a verdict?
A Russian collusion with President Trump.
Guilty or innocent? Innocent.
That's my guy right there.
Well, we've got a new program now for selecting candidates for the future, which I think will be a very, very good program.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a tiger by the toe.
The man found alive after being trapped in a cave in the Brecon Beacons turned to people smugglers as a way out.
Each episode is 15 minutes long and lampoons events in British news. On occasion, I'm not sure what's going on, not because of the production, but because the news items they skewer are very particular to England. Same with the cultural and historical references, but mostly I can read between the lines and suss out the point they're making.
That is so unfair, I hate you!
The former cabinet minister resigned.
The podcast has received many accolades, including 3 just this year from the New York festivals for comedy, sound art, and innovation. Tony Chernside is the sound engineer. John Holmes is the producer. Holmes is a comedian, and he's worked on comedy broadcasts for the BBC since the late 90s. In fact, The Skewer is categorized as comedy, but I wonder if social commentary would be more accurate.
Today is the first day of the famous Harrods sale, where people can get their most amazing bargains across the store.
The biggest shopping days of the year.
The big sale today. We wake up 5 o'clock in the morning to get up to come early to get the good deal.
Came here to buy a lot of home stuff and maybe some grabs, some more good deals for me.
We didn't look at the price when we picked it up. So we'll see it on the receipt when we get home.
We've also heard of like massive sales and stuff, and we've seen those people come out with bags from Next, and we've been queuing up here.
London, arguably the capital city of the world.
Everyone's going shopping. Everything's like on sale, and we will just take like double the money and get more things.
Get more things. Get more things.
The United Nations Special Envoy says over half of Zimbabwe's population faces starvation.
There are suddenly thousands of mouths to feed.
Mum always says my money doesn't grow on trees.
Man-made starvation.
Trouble's coming, and they know it.
So just because it's weird and breaks new ground doesn't mean it automatically is deserving of a laurel, though that's partly why I'm doling one out to The Skewer. But I'd say the show earned a laurel for the production values, the same reason I lauded NPR at the top of this episode. It's audio technicolor. There's a manic precision to the production that leaves Radiolab in the dust. The mix is impeccable. The cuts and transitions are immaculate. The scoring and sound design top-notch. It's so layered and quick, you could listen a few times and still not catch everything that's happening. It's like trying to see every color in a Pollock painting. Though with each episode, I want to try. A laurel to The Skewer from BBC Radio 4.
I have concluded that all those working in the NHS will have to be vaccinated.
You know, as well as I do, all young doctors indulge in a bit of jiggery pokery.
As many as 200,000.
Now, don't worry, it's just a little trick.
NHS and care employees.
I have one more dart and laurel to toss out. It's for The Flamethrowers, a CBC podcast about the impact of right-wing radio. About the impact of right-wing radio on American politics. You can find my thoughts on that show at the post for this episode of House Sound over at transom.org. House Sound is a co-production of PRX and Transom. A laurel to Genevieve Sponsler at PRX for enduring my scripts and marking them up. And another laurel to my colleagues, Jay, Vicky, Sid, and Jen, the Transom crew in Woods Hole. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Thanks for listening.
I am so sorry.
From PRX. And Transom.org.